This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, and WILL-FM and HD3, Urbana.
Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 12, 2012, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the author of a new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. It's a book that's sweeping the nation. It's causing a lot of talk. And we're going to talk about it for the full hour today with our guest, Chris Hayes, the author. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The new Islamist president of Egypt today ordered two of his top generals to retire. President Mohamed Morsi also canceled a constitutional declaration issued by the military just before the election that had sharply curtailed the president's powers. Until now, the country's top general still held much of the power. Thousands of people are homeless in northwestern Iran after two major earthquakes yesterday. The Interior Minister says that at least 227 people were killed. Another 1,300 people were injured. The BBC's Peter Biles has more.
The two earthquakes had struck just 11 minutes apart. Scores of villages suffered damage. Six are said to have been flattened completely. But a short while ago, Iran's Interior Minister announced that search and rescue operations were ending. The authorities say the emphasis is shifting to the job of getting shelter and supplies to the survivors. Iran's Red Crescent has provided thousands of tents, blankets, and tons of food. One of Iran's neighbors, Turkey, has also sent aid to the border region.
The BBC's Peter Biles reporting. Top Democrats and Republicans are squaring off on the Sunday talk shows over Republican Mitt Romney's choice of Paul Ryan for his running mate. Meanwhile, Romney and Ryan are on the campaign trail today. NPR's Allison Keyes has more.
In North Carolina, Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan was getting much love from the crowd, telling them President Obama came in with so much promise, but...
You know what, North Carolina? We can do better than this. Help is on the way.
Former Republican presidential nominee John McCain told Fox News Sunday Ryan's an excellent choice.
A man who understands the most compelling challenges this nation faces, obviously, are jobs in the economy.
But the president's senior campaign advisor, David Axelrod, told NBC's Meet the Press that Ryan will thrill only one set of GOP voters.
The Tea Party, the social conservatives. I think it's going to be troubling to the mainstream of the American electorate.
He says the president disagrees with Ryan's ideas on the direction of government. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
As the Olympics draw to a close in London today, attention is switching to the legacy of the Games. NPR's Philip Reeves says Britain's prime minister wants more done to prevent children from going hungry.
Cameron's spending the final afternoon of the Games hosting a hunger summit. A multitude of kids around the world haven't a hope of developing into the kind of top-class Olympians who've been displaying their skills over the past 2 weeks. Their chances are ruined because by the age of two, their growth and intellectual and physical potential is stunted by disease and poor diet. Experts reckon at least 170 million children are right now facing that prospect. Cameron's co-hosting this summit with Brazil, who are holding the 2016 Olympics. They're urging global leaders dramatically to reduce that number before the next Games begin. Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News in Washington. At the Olympics today in London, it is the final day of competition. A gold medal was awarded in men's basketball. The U.S. beat Spain 107-100. Kevin Durant scored 30 points, LeBron James had 19, and Kobe Bryant added 17 for the Americans. After a spectacular landing last week, NASA's new rover remains healthy on the surface of Mars, but its science mission has yet to begin. NPR's Jim Hawk says engineers are working to finish some critical software updates.
NASA's Curiosity rover is undergoing a multi-day software upgrade, deleting the landing software in favor of a version optimized for surface operations. While the rover was undergoing what NASA termed a brain transplant, Curiosity did manage to send back 79 high-definition images of its surroundings on Mars. The full-resolution color images show a landscape resembling portions of the southwestern United States. The six-wheeled Curiosity also has video footage of the landing in its computer memory, but that won't get uploaded until the new software update is verified on both the main and backup computers. Curiosity will then be ready to begin its two-year science mission. Jim Hawk, NPR News.
A Sikh temple in suburban Milwaukee held a prayer service today. More than 100 people attended. It was the first service since last Sunday when a gunman walked into the temple and started firing. He killed six people before he fatally shot himself. Among those killed last week was the temple president. Witnesses say he was shot as he tried to stop the attacker. The gunman has been identified as a white supremacist. Investigators say they may never know what prompted his attack. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 12th, 2012. Our guest today, Chris Hayes, host the show Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC every Saturday and Sunday morning. He's an editor at The Nation, and he is also the author of a new book that is shooting up the bestseller charts, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, just published by Crown Books. It's been a great year for you, Chris Hayes. Welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And after I read your book, it's not as great a year for the United States of America.
Well, I mean, it's been a rough decade at the very least. I think it's been, when you take a step back and you look at what I call in the book the fail decade, it's been a pretty bad run. And I think when you think about the conditions of both the 2008 presidential election and this presidential election particularly, I mean, the specter that haunts it is the specter of decline, the specter of dysfunction, you know, the sense that things aren't working. And that, to me, is really the defining feature of American public life.
You know, looking back at American history, is there any comparable period that you can think of? Are we in terra incognita?
You know, I think there's some similarities, I think, in the late 1960s, early 70s, in terms of the kind of sense in which there was a crisis of authority. And things were written about in those terms much more explicitly in the late 1960s, early 1970s. I mean, that was the topic of a lot of public debate, whereas now I think we have the same phenomenon, which is this cratering trust in our pillar institutions, but it's not the topic of our debate. I think there's some similarities to the late 1970s in terms of the kind of malaise, the infamous malaise speech that didn't use the word malaise, but the sense in which the country feels adrift or not that functional. And there's other periods as well, although I think much of the particularities of where we are right now are produced, I think, by a lot of things having to do with kind of post-World War II global economics and politics that it's hard to find analogs for before that period.
Yeah, I mean, I was there in the late 60s and early 70s, quite young then, but still, and the mood was, you know, there were some similarities, but the mood was quite different, and I think, ironically, quite optimistic relative to the mood today in terms of what was capable of being done.
Yeah, and I think that has to do with what you had. I mean, you had such vibrant social movements at the time, And so that right now we have the kind of disillusion with the current authorities and the frustration without necessarily the vibrancy of movements that seem to be driving towards some alternate future.
Chris Hayes, our guest, author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. The phone lines are open here at WILL if you want to call in and have a question or comment for Chris Hayes, who also is the host of the MSNBC program Up with Chris Hayes. every Saturday and Sunday morning. You're coming up on a year anniversary for that, aren't you, Chris?
Yeah, we are. In September, we had a year, which I'm pretty excited about.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting. And, you know, Chris, you outline in the book sort of what you call a crisis of authority, which is pretty much across the board, every major institution in the United States today, which isn't original. But what's original is you link it to this idea of an American meritocracy that emerges in the 1960s and has deteriorated, degenerated. I'll let you explain it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when you look at this record of elite failure, you start looking naturally at how elites are selected and how they're formed. And the process of elite selection in the country is, you know, since the 1960s, is the meritocracy. And that's the name for both a social model and a set of institutions for, you know, a social model in terms of how we think who should be in the elite and how they get there, and then the actual institutions that do that process of selection. And the basic idea is, you know, coming out of the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement and second wave feminism, this belief that we should not bar entrance to the American elite based on things like gender, race, geographical background, creed, etc., that people from all walks of life and all different backgrounds are going to compete on a level playing field, and then through this kind of competitive, iterative funneling process, almost like a tournament, they get selected down to the small group that will, you know, attain the positions of greatest influence, power, and remuneration. And the problem is that the idea behind it is that it's going to provide you know, a certain amount of churn and social mobility, that it's going to allow the, you know, if you're a bright kid who's from the Bronx, you know, you'll end up at Goldman Sachs, and if you're a oafish dullard son of a, you know, investment banker, then you won't just, you know, inherit your father's job. And the reality is that it just is not delivering on its core promise. I mean, we've seen during the same time that that's been the social model in America. We've seen that social mobility has actually declined. You know, it's declined since over time. I mean, you have lower odds of starting out born into a household in the bottom quintile of the income distribution and working your way into the top quintile. You have a lower odds now than you did 20 or 40 years ago.
In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Chris, of all the industrial countries, we rank at the bottom or near the bottom in social mobility, and the ones that rank at the very top are the social democracies of Northern Europe.
Yeah, and that part of that has to do with the fact that there's, and this is something that I write about in the book, is that one of the kind of conceit of meritocracy and the way that we think about social mobility and inequality is that you can separate inequality of opportunity from equality of outcomes, right? So you can say you're going to allow, you know, a wide disparity between rich and poor, but you're going to make sure that everyone has a shot to be rich by making sure that there's equality of opportunity. And the reality that we've seen both here in the States and comparatively is that those two are just not that divisible. One will come to subvert the other if you have a vastly unequal society in terms of the outcomes that either the market produces, or your criminal justice system produces, or your political system produces, or all three together produce. If you have huge disparities in the inequality of outcomes, that will come to subvert the mechanisms by which you attempt to provide some kind of level playing field.
When, Chris Hayes, did this system of modern meritocracy work at its best? Would you say the 60s and 70s into the 80s? When was it, let me rephrase that, when was it more possible for people who were born outside of positions of privilege to, you know, move to the top of the elite, corporate ranks, governmental, whatever institution in society? What was the peak moment of that, would you think?
I think it's beginning. I mean, I think in the 60s and 70s, I do think that there's certain ways in which it has succeeded in ways in which, you know, the American elite is unquestionably more diverse than it was 40 years ago. Barack Obama is the crowning glory of the meritocracy. I mean, in every conceivable way, both, you know, the institutions, Columbia, Harvard Law School, that he is a product of, but also in the fact that there's no other period of time in American history in which it would be conceivable that a man with that name, that background, that skin color would be president of the United States. And so the meritocracy has been successful in certain ways, and there are certain aspects of it, you know, certain aspects of the vision of it that are quite noble and admirable. But I don't think it's ever quite lived up. I think in some ways it's sort of bound to fail, and I'm not sure if it's ever really produced what it claimed it would.
Yeah, you call that the iron law of meritocracy, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
And explain that, if you would, to our listeners.
Just, yeah, it's the idea that I just, sort of the idea I said before, which is that you will, if you create a system in which you say that, you know, we don't care about equality of outcomes, we're just going to provide a level playing field and equality of opportunity, that the inequality will just ultimately consume everything in the system, and you will end up with a set of elites who manage to figure out ways to game the system. So you won't have a level playing field. You will have a system in which privilege is passed on through kinship networks or in a hereditary fashion, in which you do end up with something that looks a lot more like oligarchy, a small, sort of easily predictable, tight-knit circle of people with a whole lot of power. And using that power to change the rules of the system to preserve that power and make sure that they lock themselves into power.
You know, it's funny, Chris Hayes, as you were in the book, you talk about this, and as you were talking now, people who benefit by the meritocracy, President Obama, classic case, who are people who rise to power who wouldn't have been able to a generation or two earlier at any other time in American history, in Obama's case, obviously. But not just President Obama. But it seems that people who are beneficiaries of this innately then develop, well, this system must be pretty good if I rise to the top of it, understands that I'm so talented, then this can't be that bad of a system. It sort of builds in an innate conservatism, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's tempting to think that a system that has elevated you to the top knew what it was doing.
Yeah, I mean, who's not going to like the system?
I think you find this. I mean, what's interesting to me is that you don't actually get most critiques of meritocracy in its modern form come from the right, and they come from the kind of David Brooks sort of nostalgia school. You don't get a lot of left liberal critiques of meritocracy. I mean, you have some, but a lot of it is that, you know, it's, I think liberals tend to think that it's kind of self-evidently how society should work, and part of that is because a lot of successful liberals, and, you know, I guess I count myself in that, are part of the are produced by those institutions, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's funny along those lines because I know lots of people similar to you who've been successful and in that situation, and to a far lesser extent myself. But and it's like once you've gone through the Ivy League thing and risen to the top and first in your generation to ever do that in your family's history, maybe go to college even, there's a sense, well, now that I've made it, these other people who are at the same institution must be really smart too. You know, there's a deference to traditional authority that's sort of striking.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think that one of the things that, one of the ironies here, right, is that you have, you tend to trust your fellow meritocrats.
That's the point I was getting at, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, and that's something that Jonathan Alter makes this point very explicitly in the book he wrote about the first year of Obama's administration. You know, where not only, you know, Barack Obama is the sort of central irony and tragedy of his, well, tragedy might be overstating at the moment, but central irony, I would say, of his tenure is that he basically is the crowning achievement of meritocracy at the moment the meritocracy is imploding all around us. And at the same time that the populace has a tremendous amount of distrust in authority, the president, I think, is pretty disposed to actually have a fair amount of deference, and has kind of, he's a real institutionalist, as I talk in the book about that. But, you know, I think he really has kind of respect for the pillar institutions in American life. I don't think he views them as irredeemably corrupt or bankrupt. And it's almost as if he's trying to sort of will them back into functioning through that trust. But that, I think, in some ways removes him from the felt experience of the majority of Americans who feel
tremendous degrees of distrust and betrayal.
Our guest, Chris Hayes, you've just been listening to. Chris Hayes is the author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, just published by Crown. Chris Hayes is also the host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC cable channel every Saturday and Sunday morning. Chris, you, in addition to doing the show, you write for The Nation magazine. You have a daughter who's less than a year old. How on earth did you find time to write this book?
Well, I wrote the book basically before. I think it would be very hard to write the book while doing the show. I finished the draft. I basically finished the manuscript, the first draft of the manuscript, a month or so before the show started. And then there was a very intense spell right after my daughter was born around Christmas of last year in which I had to do a revision on the manuscript, and my daughter was like 3 weeks old and doing the show.
Was she colicky?
She was not, actually. We were very lucky.
Yeah, otherwise the book wouldn't exist.
Yeah, exactly, or it would have gotten delayed quite a bit. But no, it's been quite a year in terms of juggling a bunch of these different things. But I'm very happy to be done with book tour, as much fun as that was, and be back spending time at home with her and my wife and working on the show.
And if folks want to call on to WILL with a question, the line is open at 217-333-9455 and our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And we do have a couple of people who have emailed questions in to me, and I'm going to turn to those right now while people call in if they want. And Joy from Illinois asks you, Chris, how can Democrats explain the subtle differences between Paul Ryan's proposed cuts to Medicare beneficiaries and the Affordable Care Act's cuts to providers?
I'm sorry. Could
you just put on your hat as an expert in medical policy.
What was the question again?
The question is, Chris, how can Democrats explain the subtle differences between Paul Ryan's proposed cuts to Medicare beneficiaries,
right,
or recipients, and the Affordable Care Act's, Obamacare's, cuts to providers?
Well, the question does a pretty good job. I mean, I think people understand the difference between providers and beneficiaries. The irony, of course, is going to be the through-the-looking-glass world we're about to enter is one in which there's a debate about who's cutting Medicare the most. People forget that the way the Tea Party came to power in 2010 was running against the, quote, $500 billion cut to Medicaid, a Medicare that was represented by the Affordable Care Act, and that worked that time around. But I do think that this is one of those places where the reputational capital that's been built up by a political coalition or party matters a great deal. And if the battle is who is, I think people understand which party they should trust on that core issue.
What's your sense of November right now? And I don't want to get into the lame thing of just prognosticating, but what sort of campaign do you anticipate? What's your sense of the mood of the populace?
You know, it's a pretty dispirited mood. I think, you know, it's a combination of that kind of fear of decline and frustration with the status quo that, you know, the country is not in great shape and the economy is really not in great shape. And it's sort of remarkable to me, in fact, how, you know, absent a jobs agenda seems from the campaign. But that's kind of another point. I think, you know, I think it's going to be brutally close, actually. I think it's, there's structural reasons why it's going to be brutally close, because it remains in certain ways something of a 50-50 nation. But I think it's going to be brutally close, and I think that, you know, ultimately the president will prevail, just because I think that's the advantage of incumbency, and I think the political team they have is quite good, and the record is actually quite good, or good enough to carry him over the hump at a time when the actual conditions of the country would make re-election a challenge.
And we have another question for you, Chris Hayes, via email. This one from Portland, Maine, and it asks, Chris, what is your opinion on the U.S. track record on indefinite detentions and global surveillance of pre-crime? this is our Ask Chris Hayes show.
Yeah.
Any question on American politics, email it in.
Yeah, I think indefinite detention, both the kind that was exposed during the Bush administration, and, you know, there's different kinds of indefinite detention that exist right now under U.S. supervision in other countries. I'm not a civil liberties, national security reporter. I don't report actively on civil liberties issues, which isn't to say we discuss them on the show all the time, and we have people on. But, you know, it's this really difficult area to report on because of the insane growth of secrecy in the last 10 years, and a growth in secrecy that has been preserved and expanded by this administration, and that has made just even getting, you know, the necessary precondition to debates about policy is to have a set of facts on the table. And it's kind of remarkable to just compare something like, you know, when we're having these budget fights, we're all at least dealing with public information. The CBO estimates are all public. When you have debates about policy having to do with the things like indefinite detention abroad or drone strikes and kill lists, you know, the maddening fact is that the public record is just so incomplete. And when it is filled in, often it's filled in because of someone in power having an agenda to give out the information. So it's very hard to have – I always find myself sort of frustrated and bewildered in even trying to assemble the necessary information as a precondition to having the debate.
You know, Chris Hayes, in the book you talk about the crisis of authority, how all institutions are really – awash in degrees of corruption that are unusual for generations, if not ever. And just your comments then made me think of, where does the military and secrecy and national security, where does it fit into this picture where all these other institutions are, in crisis?
Well, the military is the most trusted institution in American life by far. And I think that's sort of a fascinating window into where we are. I mean, I think there's a variety of reasons. One is that, you know, we've ostensibly been at war for a decade. I mean, we've definitely been at war for a decade in a very distinct sense in Afghanistan. But the broader war on terror, and so I don't think it's, I think across different cultures that esteem for the military is often connected to people's sense of being directly threatened. I think other institutions have performed so poorly, the military looks good in comparative terms. And I also think, you know, and I don't write about this book, I started to write about it and sort of gone back and forth and thought about it more. You know, the military is an institution that, for whatever its institutional flaws, and there are, you know, many, and can be listed in all sorts of ways, it also embodies a vision that's quite different than the kind of vision of radical inequality that is the vision of American social life elsewhere. I mean, there's a kind of, within the military, there is much less social distance between different members of it than there is in American society at large. And I think that there's something about that it feels orthogonal to the way that American life is ordered in the 21st century in every other way, and I think makes people, it seems like an alternate model that seems attractive to people.
Our guest, Chris Hayes, author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After a Meritocracy, published by Crown Books. Chris Hayes also is the host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC Saturday and Sunday mornings. The number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go to our phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. I really don't understand the basic premise of this. The meritocracy, I don't believe, ever exists. That we've had an old boys network and government by connections. You give Barack Obama's presidency as some kind of example of the triumph, and I just, you know, it's not true. It seems to me, anybody, Romney and Ryan, but Barack Obama was a very conventional state senator in a lot of ways. He was called a senator from Exelon when he was state senator, and I don't know if you know Illinois politics, but the Jerry and Jim Ryan sex scandal that had him running against the buffoon Alan Keyes was a lot of the serendipity of how he got elected to the Senate.
So I actually lived in Illinois and Chicago for 6 years. I covered that race pretty closely. So I don't think the point is less whether he's conventional or not. I think is sort of parallels to the point about the fact that someone of his background being the position he is in is a distinct feature of the nature of how the American elite are selected right now. I just think it's not plausible to think that he would have been elected in 1940 or 1960. And I think that has to do with the way that what you call the old boys networks have changed. I mean, I just think if you look at who occupies positions of authority in American life, it is very white and very male, or is disproportionately white and disproportionately male and even disproportionately WASP, but far less than it was 20 or 40 years ago.
Caller, do you want to follow up? I guess the caller hung up to listen to your sterling words, Chris. You know, in the book, Chris, you talk at some length about this notion of elites and how the right wing and the left wing have different understandings of elites, and the relationship of elites in our culture to the 1%, the common term for those who own the country. What's your take on this? What are elites, and what's their relationship to the people who, you know, own all the businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the right has managed to appropriate the word elite in a really effective and insidious way, but also just a really misleading way and kind of redefine the word as describing people that have a set of certain cultural attributes or consumer preferences and drive Priuses and live in San Francisco and things like that, as opposed to the traditional meaning of the word, which is relative. I mean, it's contested because any sufficiently, you know, complex concept will be contested, but it's not really been that contested in the sense that, you know, what the elite means as being a relatively small group of people with a disproportionate influence over society's direction, that has been the way that the term has been understood for most of the, you know, several hundred years that people have been writing about elites in the modern context. And I think part of the project of the book is just reclaiming that.
And, you know, you talk in the book about the common ground of outsiders, insurgents, the Tea Party on one side, the Occupy movement on the other side. Explain what your thinking is there, your argument there, because, you know, to put it into context, on this program we've had guests over the last year who have dismissed that as ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the uniting theme for the frustration people have is a sense of betrayal and a sense that the game is not square and that the rules are rigged. And I think that's, you know, the game is rigged is a phrase I've heard a lot, and I've heard from Tea Party people and from Occupy people. Now, obviously, there are these huge ideological and sometimes tribal differences between these different coalitions. And they may, in fact, be unbridgeable, and they may not even be something that is worthwhile to attempt to bridge. But I also think that, you know, if you look through American history, the contours of how the politics are defined change, and the nature of the political coalitions change, and they're not set in stone, they're not fixed, essential. They're not essential in the sense that they kind of grab something that is inherently out there in the world. They're the product of what issues are most important and what kind of different coalitions of interest form. I mean, if you look at Prohibition or you look at Reconstruction, you get very different coalitions, and it just seems possible to me that there are different coalitions imaginable in American politics.
You know, do you see some evidence, and I'm not asking this either rhetorically or facetiously, but earnestly, that in the Tea Party movement, which granted began, say, in 2009, and a big part of its opening salvo was this campaign against corruption and bailouts, and I think a sort of message that resonated well with people who weren't on the political right. And then it seemed like almost in a nanosecond, the Koch brothers moved in, and it became a campaign to lower taxes on billionaires first and foremost. And the whole thing about corruption got sort of thrown right out the window and never heard from again, except maybe in some rhetorical manner that had nothing to do with reality. Are there some, am I missing something? Because to make this case, I'd love to see some examples of, actually in Kentucky, there's some Tea Party section that, is trying to do something different.
No, I mean, I think that's more or less right. I mean, part of it also, I think, has to do with the fact that, like, at the end of the day, the Tea Party are conservatives, like, and they're conservative, like, it's just a name for folks that are conservative, and they are people who, are much more religious than the people who aren't Tea Party. They, like, have, they dislike welfare more than the average vote. I mean, they just fit all the profiles of conservatives, mm-hmm. But I do think that they're conservatives who are refracting the reality of institutional failure through their own personal prism. And I think, there were some, if the failure is big enough, that can change the way people think about what they trust and what they don't trust. And you wonder if in those moments, it's the moments closest to the failures where that kind of overlap seems most possible, right?
Mm-hmm. Chris, in the book, Twilight of the Elites, that we're talking about, your new book with Crown Books, in the book you have, I started reading the book, and if someone told me what the book was about, I never would have expected, long, relatively lengthy discussions of the steroids crisis in baseball, mm-hmm. or the sex scandals and crises in the Catholic Church. How do they tie into your thesis?
Yeah, I mean, steroids in baseball is really a perfect little microcosm of a very fundamental principle that I sort of interrogate in the book, which is that it turns out to be harder than it looks to create a system with high rewards for performance that isn't also a system with high rewards for cheating. And this is the case in Major League Baseball, which is Major League Baseball really is a meritocracy, right? It is a place where people's background or, doesn't matter very much. If you're a 19-year-old kid from the Dominican Republic who doesn't speak English, but you can throw a fastball, you're going to, get paid a lot of money. And they have punishment for failure. If you're an aging slugger who's doing that, you get benched. And what the steroid scandal in baseball illustrates is that it turns out that if you create a system with really high rewards for performance and punishment for failure and, something that looks like a perfect meritocracy, you also create very ripe conditions for cheating and an epidemic of cheating. And that's, I think, a really important point, not because of cheating in Major League Baseball such a big deal, but because actually a lot of American life is increasingly structured that way. American institutions, Enron was structured in that way. Wall Street is very self-consciously structured as kind of a perfect meritocracy in which people are constantly being evaluated on their performance and given huge bonuses for performance. And it's not surprising then that we see such endemic cheating.
And I mean, and the point you make in the book, and I think it's central to the argument, is that the cheating not only is growing, it's not only rampant and prevalent, but it's for those at the top, it's no longer punished.
That's right. And one of the things you see from Major League Baseball is that if the only thing you have to stop cheating is that a norm against cheating is actually much more powerful than a rule, but norms, when they go very quickly. And so what you've seen is this kind of degradation of the norms, particularly on Wall Street. And, once they go, you need to have rules or some sort of institutional reform. Otherwise, you're just going to have, disaster.
And where does the Catholic Church sex scandals come into play?
Well, for me, the Catholic Church is a great illustration of the concept of social distance, as I call it in the book, which is the vast distance between elites and, decision makers and the people who those decisions affect. And when you try to solve the mystery of how it was that the Church could have done what it did, the only real answer is the fact that the bishops were so removed from the lives of their parishioners, and they felt solidarity with the predators rather than the prey, and that to me is a really it's a really key point to illustrate, because I think, you know, the evil that was allowed to happen in the church is inevitable product of an institutional setup in which the people who make decisions, in this case the bishops, are not embedded in the same world as the people that those decisions affect.
Our guest Chris Hayes is joining us live on the phone lines on the phone today. So if you want to call in to Media Matters and have a question or comment for Chris, the number 217-333-9455, our toll-free number, is 800-222-9455. And we have another email, Chris, that came in to the Ask Chris Hayes About Anything show today. This is from Ventura, California. Is there a Mormon economic political agenda, and should the media play a role in covering it during the election?
I have no idea.
Oh, come on, Chris. This is like open season today. Any question? I've had no guests who could answer this, so I guess they figure Chris Hayes, TV star, Cam.
I don't know enough about the economic theology of the Church of Latter-day Saints to answer that question.
I will say one thing on the inside baseball to get at this. You know, Harry Reid is a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there's some sort of, you know, because he seems to take particular delight in thrashing George Romney,
yeah,
or Mitt Romney, if there's some backstory there.
Yeah, I mean, I and also with all the speculation about the taxes and such, I do know that, you know, Mormons, there's been some interesting reporting about just Mormons pretty much kind of quietly and behind the scenes really mobilizing behind the candidacy, which is not surprising, obviously, if, you know, Greek-American was at the head of a ticket, that I think the Greek-American community would mobilize for them, and Jewish-American at the top of the ticket, you'd see the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty accurate. One thing that is interesting, though, you know, let's say that Dennis Kucinich got the Democratic nomination, or Bernie Sanders or someone, and he was a Mormon. Either of them were Mormon. I wonder if in the sort of evangelical circles that would suddenly become a much larger issue than it apparently is now. It's just, you know,
yeah,
idle thought of the day here.
Bob, I'm really sorry to do this. I know that I'm slated for the hour. Actually, I have to go attend to my daughter.
Can you come back, or is this going to be a full throttle?
Can I give me 5 minutes and just to attend to her? I'm really sorry to do
that's
this.
That's quite all right. We understand, Chris, and thank you for your time. We'll wait for you if we can. I'll let my producer know your status if there's any other problems, okay?
Awesome. Thank you, Bob.
Sure thing, Chris. That was Chris Hayes, who's joining us, and obviously he's taking time out of his Sunday, and he has a daughter who is 9 months old, Ryan, who he's tending to in Brooklyn, his apartment. And we are therefore free here. We'll wait for Chris to call back, hopefully in 5 minutes, and if not, we will probably just conclude the hour with some music. But in the meantime, if people want to call in with questions or comments to talk about anything, suggestions for possible guests, the works, the lines are open at 217-333-9455 and the toll-free line open at 1-800-222-9455. Chris Hayes, of course, our guest, who just had to leave us, hopefully briefly, to attend to his daughter, is the author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, and he is also the host of Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC every Saturday and Sunday morning. Coming weeks, we have some guests lined up for you. Next week, we have Amy Goodman, who will be our live guest. And Amy often joins us on our pledge drive shows. She's very gracious about coming on air to try to implore you to send money into WILL. And we'd like to get her on periodically for a live show so she can just talk to you about journalism, politics, and the work she does that I know many of you are keenly interested in. So it should be a terrific show. We're really looking forward to it. 2 weeks from today, we will have a recorded show. We have an evergreen show, we call it, one of our greatest hits. And it will be the show Hot Coffee, which is, I think, one of the favorite shows I've ever done here. One of the pleasures of doing Media Matters is when I get to cover a topic that hasn't been talked about much anywhere else with an author who's or a public figure who hasn't really gotten a great deal of attention. And Hot Coffee was one of those shows. The guest was a lawyer who made a documentary about public injury law and how it's been crushed out by commercial and corporate interest and reduced, and what a loss that has been for American people. One of the key weapons they had to protect their interest against corporate power had been lost to them. And you know, so that's a show. If you didn't hear it the first time a year ago, you're going to really love the show. It's absolutely eye-opening. I want to go back to our phone lines now. We've got someone who's taken us up on the offer to join us on the air. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Perhaps you could comment on this, too. But as I was listening to this conversation, that it seems like the conservative right-wing has done such a good job of convincing the average person that we can't punish those who've been successful by taxing them. And we don't look at least, you know, the conservatives, the Tea Partiers, et cetera, don't look at how government benefits have allowed these people to be successful. Like even the Tea Partiers, I think of, where would these people be without things like Social Security or Medicare that help take care of their parents, their grandparents? And so I think, you know, like I said, the right just does such a good job of doing this propaganda campaign so we don't look at those issues. And maybe you can comment on that.
Well, thank you, caller. Well, you know, I think this was become an issue in the presidential campaign in the last few weeks, as President Obama made a comment roughly to the effect that no one got rich without the support of the infrastructure the government creates and the education system and all the various other public sector provisions that make it possible for someone even to make money in the first place. And famously, Bill Gates Sr., the father of Bill Gates, said, you know, the only reason Bill Gates existed, was able to make the gazillion dollars he's made, is that he grew up in the United States and had all sorts of structures in place that made it possible for Bill Gates Jr. to get so wealthy, and that had he been born in most any other country, it would have been impossible. And Bill Gates' talent did not sort of ride roughshod over everything else. He required having a public sector and an infrastructure to make it possible. And that has become a highly contentious point at the Republican Party, now with Paul Ryan just making this comment yesterday and today, in fact, sort of taking aim at that as being a sign that the President Obama doesn't have sufficient appreciation for entrepreneurs and claims government does everything. A misreading, I think, of the president's comments. And it's worth noting that the president took those comments from Elizabeth Warren, who made them in her race for U.S. Senate in Massachusetts a few months ago, and it became viral on the internet and extremely well embraced by the liberal community, which was glad to hear someone forcefully make that argument, really for the first time in public by a major figure, because there's so much deference generally to business and entrepreneurs that even to make that argument was considered fairly radical. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We've only got about 11 minutes left in the show. Our guest today is Chris Hayes, the host of the show Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC every Saturday and Sunday morning. And Chris is the author of a new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. We've been talking about it for the full hour. Chris is also the father of a lovely young daughter, Ryan, and he has had to leave the show momentarily to tend to her. And unfortunately, we now hear that the situation is such, Chris will not be back on the air with us. We're going to keep the phone lines open if people want to call in with questions or comments or recommendations for potential guests. Anything goes. It's open lines now for the next 10 minutes here at Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. The number 217-333-9455. Or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And feel free, if you wish, to email your comments or questions in, too. And we're going to give you a list as soon as my producer gets it to me via email. We will get a list of upcoming guests and some of the future shows to you as well. We've got a number of people lined up for September, some really terrific shows that Christina Williams, my producer's been working on. So it's an exciting lineup we've got going into the fall. And again, I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters, and you're listening to WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. You know, we've been doing the show now. I just, for a number of reasons, went back and looked at the records. We've done just about 500 shows exactly, original shows. A number get played over, but we do just under 50 a year. And then now we've been on the air now for 10 years and 4 or 5 months. So it's been a long run here at WILL, and it's been a fantastic experience for me. The station has been exceptionally supportive, so it's been a great honor for me to have a station that has stood behind me, allowed me to do a type of programming here that I think you only hear me talk about on pledge drives, but now I've got this opportunity, I'll do it here, a type of programming that you simply, you know, no other NPR station, to my knowledge, embraces or certainly opened the doors to have it. WILL has taken a chance with me, initially with Jay Pierce, and now with the people who have come since then, the subsequent managers here at the station, have really stood behind me at every turn all the way. If the type of programming we're type doing this show, they've made it possible for this programming to exist. And I know how important the show is to a lot of people. I get the emails. I get comments from folks when I'm walking around. And most strikingly, and I think this is a comment on the internet, when I travel and I'm not just only on the East or West Coast or anywhere in the United States, but even when I'm outside of the United States, I find that the listenership extends globally thanks to the internet, thanks to podcasting, and that people, and we hear, see it from the phone calls we get into the program. We've got just today, we've got California and New York each came in with questions for our guest. So, we do have another phone call. Let's go to that now. I'm Bob McChesney. Let's go to line one, Urbana. You're on Media Matters.
Hi. Hello. I was intrigued by the earlier old boys comment.
Yeah.
I really wanted to ask Mr. Hayes about this. At this point, he's not going to be able to come back. But
I can do my Chris Hayes impersonation.
We're going to shoot it at you then. So, you know, I kind of feel like there's a sense, there's a real reverse discrimination against white males in the modern meritocracy, but on the other hand, you know, there's the disproportionate demographics of the 1% really seem to say otherwise. So I was kind of interested in any insight or comments on where this sense of this reverse discrimination comes from, because you don't really see it. So I don't know. I'm just interested in any comments on that.
Well, that's one I really would like Chris to handle. I think he would do a far better job of that, I think, than I could possibly do. And I don't even want to take a stab at that. I would do injustice to Chris's argument if I were to take a stab at that. I do think, he's onto something that's very important about the fact that all sorts of ethnic groups that have been precluded, African-Americans, Latinos, Jews, really until the 1950s or 60s, from positions of great power in the United States, there's been some entry, and that's something probably that's commendable. But then I think the point that one of the callers made earlier is also worth noting, which is, you know, that President Obama's viewpoints, his politics are entirely mainstream, at least in that caller's opinion. It wasn't that he brought in a something that went outside of what the conventional range of politics in this country, or at least hasn't since he's been a president. He might have run on something different. A lot of people would argue that. I wish, again, that Chris were here, because he's really thought a lot more about that issue than I have. So I'll leave it at that point. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Line three, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, it's unfortunate they had to go, but a good cause, and it got me an opportunity to follow up on.
Yeah, I'm sorry we had to cut you off.
Well, I was gone. Line went dead, so.
Oh.
I didn't mean to leave. Though I know it's important to have a lot of different voices on and all that. But the person that wrote about the comparing the Medicaid cuts and Medicare cuts between Obama and it's true what he said, but what I have a problem with, and I'm a single payer supporter, or something along that line, that how can the Democrats convincingly argue against the voucher system for Medicaid and Medicare patients, which is what the Ryan plan is, when they're basically doing the same thing for the uninsured? We're giving you some money, and you can pass it off to a private health insurer. And it's a way of subsidizing the health insurance industry. And the voucher system that he wants to use in terms of, reforming Medicare and Medicaid is really what's being offered for the uninsured. And so there's just a very strong disconnect. I never hear it discussed, so I wanted to bring it up. As far as a guest, Nan Rubin, Prometheus, she was here for the Grassroots Radio Conference.
Mm-hmm.
She could talk about Prometheus projects. She could also do some kind of a recap of the Grassroots Radio Conference, even though it was so big and so there's no way that anyone can recap it.
Well, you know, while I've got you in the line, two things stay with this view for a second, line three. I think a lot of our listeners will recognize this caller. We call him Champaign County. I guess you're off in the woods, I guess. And you call almost every week, and your questions are almost uniformly really smart. And I just want to thank you. I've never had this opportunity.
Well, I'm glad to have the opportunity. I get to raise issues that I really think are being left on the by the wayside of the contemporary media, and there's so many important things that impinge upon what you were.
Well, our guests oftentimes say to me after the show, wow, we got some great questions online. And I've noted that usually the best shows we have are call-in shows where I get lots of questioners. You call almost every week, and I please continue to do so.
I'm listening to the replays on Focus 580 now, and I seem to be featured quite frequently there as well. And I don't think that you really would take on another couple of hours, but maybe you could do a Friday roundup.
Well, I think this is a challenge for me, as is, unfortunately.
Right, I understand.
The time commitment that it is, and I do enjoy it. And one of the reasons I do enjoy the show is people like you and all the other regular callers, and then the new callers who call in. But this is a show that was meant to be and is meant to be caller-driven. I do recorded shows periodically. I don't enjoy them anywhere near as much as when listeners have an opportunity to call in and directly ask the questions they have.
Well,
and now, what was your question again? I've already lost track of...
It wasn't so much a question. It was the idea that the person said, what about the health care reform?
I think your point's well taken, and I wish Chris Hayes were here and able to respond. I know this is an issue he has actually given a bit of thought to, both on his show, especially in his show and in his writings. And I think your point's well taken. I think, you know, one of the reasons that that this health care issue is so confusing for many Americans is that the Obama reform package is unclear to most Americans what exactly it entails, and it's a very amorphous issue for people.
Well, it doesn't stand a lot of scrutiny, I'm afraid, because when you start talking about how much money is going to be dumped into the healthcare industries, and I thought they got rid of health savings accounts, which is a real pernicious part of what the current healthcare system, and it's actually, and this is rarely talked about, it's actually undermining the current health insurance industry. What these people, this is the basic, is people who have money who don't want to, they just want to buy a high deductible insurance system. So for real bad situations, they're well enough off, but they are allowed to put money in these health savings accounts, and it's another way to shelter their money from tax. And it also undermines the health insurance industry, and I think this is in some ways a bailout of them. They want all these extra people, and we're spending government money.
Well, you're convincing me we need to do something on this probably before Election Day. It'd be great to have a show on this issue, especially as it becomes part of the political debate. But, you know, Champaign County, I've got to go to our last caller.
Oh, great, great.
Thank you again for calling.
Media Matters, by the way. Can't somebody fund that, like the Knight Foundation? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Let's go to our last caller now. Line 4, Bloomington, Illinois. You're on the air.
Producer said she could answer my question, so what I have to say is, yes, I enjoy your frequent calls that just hung up, and I really, really appreciate your program. I listen every, almost as well, I may miss a time or two, but I love your program, and I love what you do. I've read your books, and I heard the hot coffee.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Well, you know, I can't thank you enough for your kind words. They mean everything to me and to my producer, Christina Williams. And on that note, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear us out of the studio. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, and everyone at WILL. And remember, 1 week from today, 167 hours, we will be back with Amy Goodman. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for today, increasing cloudiness, the high around 82. Tonight, mostly cloudy and warmer, a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms after midnight. Tonight's low, 62. Tomorrow, showers likely in the morning, then a chance of showers in the afternoon, isolated thunderstorms possible, the high, 82.